Number 12. God's Law is No Threat to Our Freedom. In the series, Conversations About God by Graham Maxwell, recorded April 13, 1984.
Welcome to the 12th of our Conversations About God. Another look at our Heavenly Father in the larger setting of the great controversy over His character and government. The topic for our conversation this evening is God's Law is No Threat to Our Freedom. An opportunity to consider yet once again the actual requirements of God's law, particularly of the Ten Commandments. Is there anything more precious to intelligent human beings than freedom? Freedom from tyranny, freedom from fear, freedom to do the things we want to do. And we believe that God means us to be free. The good news is that God values nothing higher than our freedom. But not all His children have believed this. In fact, Satan persuaded one-third of the brilliant angels that this is not true about our God, that He is instead arbitrary, exacting, vengeful, unforgiving, and severe. And how God has worked to make it clear that He is not the kind of person His enemies have made Him out to be. And yet this war that began up in heaven, that we call the Great Controversy, continued and extended to this planet. And how many of us in this world believe Satan's lies? Even among very devout religious people, even among Christians who of all people should know better. For thousands of years now, God has sought to reveal the truth in this matter, not in claims, but with the evidence of demonstration. And last week, we considered some of the emergency measures God has used to hold the family together while He goes on demonstrating the truth. Most notable of these emergency measures has been His use of law, and most notable among the laws has been the Ten Commandments. But God's extensive use of law surely seems opposed to freedom, and it has indeed been seriously misunderstood. Consider, for example, Jesus' words on this subject to His disciples in the very first passage on the Bible reference sheet. John 14 and John 15. Jesus said, "If you love Me, you will keep My commandments." And added, "You are My friends if you do what I command you." Now, what kind of friendship is it that demands obedience? And how do you fit "keep My commandments" with "you shall know the truth and the truth will set you free"? Now, sometimes this is explained to mean we are free so long as we do exactly what we're told. Have your parents ever tried that with your children? Now, children, we want freedom in our home. And we can have freedom so long as you do exactly what you're told. Do I make myself clear? And if your children are afraid enough of you, they'll say you've made yourself clear. But inside they may have serious reservations. It seems such a contradiction. Of course, everything depends upon how we understand what it is that God has asked us to do, and how we understand the reason why He even had to ask us in the first place. I believe, as I'm sure many of you do, that all God's laws, particularly the Ten Commandments, were given for our best good. And they were given especially to preserve freedom, not to infringe upon it. But law, the use of law, has been seriously misunderstood throughout the Great Controversy. And the most notable example of misunderstanding occurred about 1,400 years after Sinai, when the Son of God came Himself to live among the people who had been especially entrusted with this revelation of God's will formulated in the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. Of all people, they should have understood it was an emergency measure with Moses there to explain. There was no need to be afraid. But when Jesus came, he found a group of people who were totally preoccupied with God's laws and with obedience to their every detail. He never had to tell them not to make a graven image. They'd learned their lesson in the discipline of Babylonian captivity, and they never sank into ordinary idolatry again. He never had to tell them which day was the Sabbath. They regarded it as their highest duty to obey all 10 of the 10 commandments. He never had to urge them to pay tithe. Matthew records they used to tithe even the tiniest things, the seeds of the mint and the anise and the cumin, you remember. Nor did Jesus ever have to tell them that they should obey the laws of hygiene. He commented on the fact that they would even strain gnats out of their goat's milk, lest they should eat a forbidden insect. Nor did he ever have to tell them to search the scriptures. He said they did it all the time, though they did it for the wrong reason in John 5:39. Nor did he ever have to tell them to be careful in their association with unbelievers. In fact, when they came in from the marketplace, they used to wash themselves in certain special ceremonial ways, lest they be contaminated by association with the Gentiles. You see, they all could say, like the rich young ruler mentioned in church last Sabbath, "All these things we have obeyed from our youth up." Now, you'd think that in the face of such a rigorous obedience and willingness to do precisely what they were told, you'd think that Jesus would be pleased and that they would recognize and welcome him when he came. But all heaven watched the incredible scene of those who claim to love God's law denouncing the lawgiver as a lawbreaker. Must have puzzled the angels a great deal. And so Jesus ventured to suggest that while they were working so hard to obey, that actually they were obeying for the wrong reason. And because they were obeying for the wrong reason, they really were not obeying at all. You can imagine how offensive this was to them. In fact, he went further and suggested that if only they knew the God who had given the law, they would keep the law for an entirely different reason, a reason that would make it possible for them to be obedient and free at the same time. The Old Testament prophets had dealt with this centuries before, you remember. Just to mention two, Amos and Isaiah had chided the people for their very reluctant Sabbath keeping. "Oh, when will the Sabbath be passed that we may buy and sell and get gain?" Amos records. And Isaiah deplores their mechanical, unthinking obedience, particularly on the Sabbath. Now, Jesus quoted those words of Isaiah and commended him for telling the truth. And what I've included on the Bible reference sheet is the words of Isaiah himself. Look at Isaiah 29:13. "The Lord said, 'These people claim to worship me, but their words are meaningless, and their hearts are somewhere else. Their religion is nothing but human rules and traditions, which they have simply memorized.' Or, as one translation has it, 'Their worship of me is but the commandments of men learned by rote.' And rote, unthinking worship is such an insult to our intelligent God." And then Jesus set out to tell the truth about his Father and the kind of obedience that is really pleasing to him. And you recall what he did at such great risk on Sabbath. It was all so innocent and good. He healed people and helped them. But those gloomy legalists were shocked, and they denounced him for disobeying the law. Think of the lawgiver being denounced as a lawbreaker. No, Jesus said, I've not come to destroy the law and the prophets, not just the Ten Commandments, the whole Old Testament. I've not come to destroy it or to misrepresent it. I've come to fulfill it, to explain it to you. And by teaching and example, especially on the Sabbath, Jesus set out to correct the wide misunderstanding of God's law and to explain what it was all about. He said, the law was given for you, especially was the Sabbath given for you, to be an advantage, not a restriction. And he said this one day as he defended the right of the disciples to pluck some ears of grain and rub them in their hands and eat them. The Sabbath was made for you. You weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath that you work so hard to keep and has become such a burden to you was given to help you, not to be a restriction, and certainly not a mere test of obedience. If only you knew the truth about God and His laws, Jesus went on, you would find that His yoke is easy and His burden is light. As he glanced at all the books of rules and regulations they had accumulated. Look at those famous words in Matthew 11:28. Come to me, all you who toil and are burdened, and I will let you rest. Let my yoke be put upon you, and learn from me. For I, though I am God, I am gentle and humble-minded. Have you ever thought of the Infinite One being humble-minded? And your hearts will find rest, for the yoke I offer you is a kindly one, and the load I ask you to bear is light. You'd think the people would be relieved to hear this right from headquarters, but instead they accused the Son of God of blasphemously misrepresenting His Father. They even said He had a devil to be talking about God and His laws like this, and they condemned Him as lawless and crucified Him as a heretic. And then the Apostle Paul took up the cause of those who denounced Jesus as a heretic and who denounced His picture of God as false, even satanic. And at first, as you know from the record, Saul also obeyed for the wrong reason. For he worshipped a tyrannical God who would be pleased to see people persecuted, imprisoned, even stoned to death to force them to obey. That's the kind of God he worshipped, had many texts, he thought, to support it, and he conducted his evangelism in the name of that God. And that's why he felt free to use so much force. And then on the Damascus Road, he saw the light, and the truth set him free. And what a difference! He didn't change his Bible, or even the name of his God, or the day he worshipped for Sabbath, or his diet, or his dress. I mean, what did he change that day? All Saul changed was his picture of God. And from then on, who has spoken more eloquently about freedom and faith and grace and that Christ is the end of legalism as a way of being saved? That we're not under law, but we're under grace, for we worship a gracious God. Of course, don't misunderstand me in my new emphasis, Paul said. Do you think my emphasis on love and trust and freedom abolishes law? As we considered last time in Romans 3:31, faith does not abolish law. Faith establishes law by putting it in its proper perspective. Now, what is the proper perspective? Well, you see, adopting Paul's understanding of the meaning of faith and trust, the person who really knows God, loves Him, and admires Him for His wise and gracious ways, feels utterly free and perfectly willing to listen to everything God has to say and to give careful heed to all of His instructions. It's only wise and sensible to do so once you're convinced God is that kind of a person. So let me tell you, said Paul, why our God, who desires his children to enjoy the dignity and freedom that I paid such a price to guarantee to them. Let me tell you why that kind of a God would make so much use of law. It was added, he said, as we considered last week, among the emergency measures. As Galatians 3 says, the law was added to be our guardian, our custodian, our attendant, our guide, to bring us back to a right relationship with God when we'll do what's right because it is right and not because we're being ordered to. That word is translated from a Greek pronounced paidagogos. Didn't have time to say much about it last week. Paid, you recognize as in pediatrician, pedodontics, means a child. The second part, agogos, means a leader. A paidagogos is a leader of children. That's what the law is. It's designed for people who behave like children. And how we have misbehaved as children. And how as sinners, in our rebelliousness and our disorderliness and our immaturity, we have needed the guidance and protection of God's laws. But behind all those regulations, behind these emergency measures, surely by now we can see a very gracious God who has used all these emergency measures for man's best good. Nothing arbitrary about them. They make very good sense, and they deserve to be intelligently obeyed. And how apparent this becomes when we look more closely at precisely what it is our God has asked us to do, particularly in the Ten Commandments. But more than that, we must understand why it is that we had to be so instructed by these emergency measures. Now look, for example, again at 1 Timothy 1, 9, 8 and 9. I used a different version last week. Look at this one from Phillips. 1 Timothy 1, 8 and 9. We know, of course, that the law is good in itself and has a legitimate function. It can also be abused. Yet we also know that the law is not really meant for the good man, but for the man who has neither principles nor self-control. If you have self-control, you don't need to be ordered to behave. But the law does not give self-control, does it? The law is an emergency measure because we lack self-control. And we need it until we recover self-control and love and trust and so be able to use our freedom aright. And this is what Paul explained to the Galatian believers who were so prone to misunderstanding of God's use of law. For look at Galatians 5:13 and several verses that follow. Look at Paul's clear understanding of God's use of law. You, my brothers, were called to be free. And I was sorry to leave out any part of it. The whole section is magnificent. You, my brothers, were called to be free. The entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. But if you are led by the Spirit, the Holy Spirit of love and truth, you are not under law. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, which is the fulfilling of the law. Joy, peace, this is what God wants, the opposite of war. Peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, people who can be trusted, gentleness, and look at the last one, self-control. That's the real meaning of the King James, temperance. That's where real self-control comes from. Now, some people want God to command and control them for the rest of eternity. And that seems so humble, and it seems so safe, but it's telling God we don't want the freedom he's paid such a price to give us. How can we hand it back and say, no, I don't want self-control, I want you to control me? Isn't it marvelous? God says, when you're fully under the influence of my Holy Spirit, I won't control you. You will have recovered the dignity and joy of self-control. Then we really have freedom once again. Now, as you know, this idea that love is the fulfilling of the law was certainly not new with Paul. Jesus had said the same thing to the inquiring lawyer, you remember. But the first one to say it was Moses. Jesus and Paul quoted the man who was instrumental in giving the commandments in the first place. Look at Deuteronomy 6:5. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. That's one half of it. And then look in Leviticus 19:17 and 18. Do not hate your brother in your heart, but love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus made it no clearer than that in words, did he? He quoted that from Moses, right from the beginning. But you cannot really command things like love and not hating your brother in your heart, can you? But when people are misbehaving, you may say so as an emergency measure. But that's all it is. It doesn't provide the lasting motivation that God desires. Then, since even love is not clearly understood, and think how it's been grossly perverted through the years, Paul added 1 Corinthians 13, 4-6. This love we're talking about that's the fulfilling of the law is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Now imagine living in a community where everyone lives as described in the Ten Commandments. That means everybody loves God and everybody loves everybody else, which means that no one's ever rude or arrogant or impatient. No one insists on having his own way. Can you imagine living in such a community? Would you be free? And then you go down through the details of the Decalogue. No one ever steals. No one ever kills. No one ever hates. No one ever lies. Everyone can be trusted. And even more than that, look at number 10. People not only never do anything wrong, no one ever wants to. That's the meaning of number 10. The one that bothered Paul so much at first, he thought God was interfering too much when he got in that deep. And finally, Paul said, that's what really guarantees our freedom. We will live in a place where people not only never do anything wrong, they will never even want to. That means they've really been healed. And more than that, according to the first commandment, everyone loves and reveres the same God. What kind of a God do they worship and admire? Every member of God's family will admire the God who values nothing higher than the freedom of his children and who has paid such a price to prove it. A God who asks for nothing more than mutual love and trust. And that produces a unity that is inherent in our faith and the fact we all love and worship the same God. When you have a group of people who live like that, you have real freedom, real peace, real security. Seen in that light, the Decalogue is a guarantee of freedom. For God says, I will always run my universe this way. I'd rather die than change it. And some of us say, God, please do not change it. Will you please always run your universe in harmony with the principles of the Ten Commandments, or we won't be really safe and free? The only difference is that when the emergency is over, there'll be no need for God to tell us to love each other and tell us to be decent neighbors. You see, the Spirit of Truth will have convinced us that it's only right and sensible to behave like that. And that's the meaning of the law being written in our hearts, where a man does his thinking. That means we've thought this through and we agree with God. That's the best way to live. That's the best way to run the universe. It's right. And that means that our self-control has been restored. It's just one commandment that doesn't seem to fit in, as we all know. Can the seventh-day Sabbath be so regarded? Isn't it at least a restriction of our freedom? You remember our conversation number 10? We entitled it, "The Reminder of the Evidence." If the Sabbath is a mere arbitrary test of our obedience, it doesn't fit into this picture, this good news we've been talking about. But if the purpose of the Sabbath is to remind us of the truth, to remind us of the freedom in the Garden of Eden, to remind us of how God set his people free from Egyptian bondage, and how Jesus died on Crucifixion Friday to set us free in that way more than any other, by telling us there was no need to be afraid of God, then keeping the seventh-day Sabbath does fit into this. For we need to be reminded of these truths that are the basis of our freedom. And God gave the Sabbath to help us, not to test our obedience. Look at Isaiah's understanding of the Sabbath in Isaiah 58:13. "If you cease to tread the Sabbath underfoot and keep my holy day free from your own affairs, if you call the Sabbath a day of joy and the Lord's holy day a day to be honored, if you honor it by not plying your trade, nor seeking your own interest, or attending to your own affairs, then you will find your joy in the Lord." Joy is one of the gifts of the Spirit of truth. What truth is it we've found that brings us such joy? The thing is, if we're willing to take time, as God has invited and asked us and urged us to do, to listen and to remember, and think of all there is to remember that is represented by the Sabbath, then we will find the joy that comes from knowing this truth about our God, that that's the kind of God we shall live with for the rest of eternity. The Sabbath then does fit in. If you were ever asked to explain why you obey God, assuming that you do, what answer would you give? Would you say, "I do what I do as a believer because God has told me to, and he has the power to reward and destroy"? Is that why you don't lie and murder? Nothing wrong in those things in themselves, but it upsets God when you do that, and that's a dangerous thing to do. Now, this might be all right for a beginner or a little child, but it makes God's laws seem so arbitrary. They have no sense in themselves. And that kind of obedience does not speak well and truly of our God. So would you rather say, "I do what I do as a believer because God has told me to, and I love him and want to please him"? Is that why you don't steal and don't commit adultery? It's not that you see anything wrong in these things in themselves. It's just that God doesn't like it when we do that. And he's been so good to us. Surely we owe it to him to do the things he's asked us to do, whether they make sense or not. Again, this does not speak well of God. It might be a little improvement from obeying from fear or desire for reward, but it still smacks of arbitrariness. It still does not speak well of God, though that's often thought to be the antidote for the first one. Could you say this? "I do what I do because more and more I'm finding it to be right and sensible to do so. And how I admire and revere the one who so advised me and even commanded me in the days of my ignorance and immaturity," hastening to add, "being still somewhat ignorant and immature, I am willing to listen to this God and to heed his commandments when he asks me to do something beyond my present understanding. That says God is not arbitrary, but that everything he's asked us to do makes such good sense we should want to do it anyway. If you can say that, then truly God's law is no threat to your freedom, and you thank him for it. James is thought to be the legalist among the Bible writers, but look at James 2, 8 and 12, the last on the list. If you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom. That's James. Even Luther didn't understand him that way. And then I ventured to add this at the end. Since Ellen White, who some of us regard as a real friend of God, since she has often been misunderstood as a legalist, I included one of her many descriptions of real obedience. Look at the bottom. The man who attempts to keep the commandments of God from a sense of obligation merely, because he is required to do so, will never enter the joy of obedience. In fact, he does not obey. True obedience is the outworking of a principle within. It springs from the love of righteousness, the love of the law of God. The essence of all righteousness is loyalty to our Redeemer. Abraham trusted God, and God said, "That's what I want. That's righteousness." This will lead us to do right because it is right, because right doing is pleasing to God. I understand that someday we will be able to stand in the presence of God and say, "God, we would do all these things from here on, whether you ever ask us to or not, because we agree with you that they are sensible and they are right." And God could say, "That's good. At last you're free. Now you've learned the truth, and the truth will set and keep you free."
That's such a beautiful statement that you read at the end and touches so deeply. But it seems to me, to come back to the topic or the title for your presentation this evening, in the very title itself, you have acknowledged that there are many who have seen God's law as a threat to our freedom. And many sincere individuals, Christians who have felt that somehow God's law was something from which we wanted to be free. For example, I've heard this text mentioned so often, Romans 10:4. Mm-hmm. Christ is the end of the law. Now, doesn't that mean real freedom from the law? Wouldn't that be the answer to the problem of the law being a hindrance to our freedom? Christ is the end of the law.
Don't have to love and behave anymore. We can be disorderly and live in chaos.
Well, no, wait. What does that text mean?
Yeah, that's the thing. The text needs to be analyzed first for the words and then for the context. First of all, the word end. Now, a rare meaning is the purpose of the law, but I doubt that's the meaning in the context. I think it means termination, all right. Law does not have an article in front of it, meaning any particular law, although whether the article is there or not is not convincing in a context. You've got to read the whole setting. Mm-hmm. In the setting, Paul, all the way through the book of Romans, is contrasting the obedience that springs from love and trust and the obedience that springs from law. And the obedience that springs from law is often the obedience that comes from fear. And that even turns us into rebels as we obey. So he comes to 10:4. It's interesting, 10:4, doesn't that mean the end of something in journalism? 10:4. Christ is the 10:4. Christ is the termination of law as a way of being saved. That's the meaning.
All right.
It's the end of legalism, is what that means. Phillips has a marvelous rendering of that. Christ means the end of the struggle for righteousness by works of law, that everyone who has faith in God may be saved. That's beautifully done.
But along with a text like Romans 10:4, I think of the one in Romans 6, which I can hear someone asking. It says we're not under the law, but under grace. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that another statement of real freedom? to not be under the law, but under grace.
And again, what's the meaning of being under the law? And we often explain that as meaning we're not under the condemnation of the law. I think, again, it's this contrast with Paul, that in our relationship with God, we're not under law, we're under grace. We do not deal with a legalistic God. We deal with a God who is graciousness personified. And he says, if you realize you're dealing with a gracious God, then that helps to get rid of sin. He said, when you're dealing with God in a legalistic manner, it even provokes to sin. And you remember in Romans 7, Paul describes this. He says, there was a day when I looked at the law and it provoked me to sin, especially number 10, irritated me, until I realized God's gracious purpose in giving it to us. Now he says, I delight in the law. So one really cannot understand law until one understands God's gracious purpose, which means one has to know what he's like. And that's his message. We do not deal with a God of legalism, but a God of graciousness. Makes all the difference in the world. That makes sin even more serious.
And then what you're saying is that in that setting, the law has a proper place.
Very much so.
One of God's emergency
measures.
Very
wisely chosen emergency measures, yes.
You've spoken about various of the Ten Commandments, but as I think about the seventh-day Sabbath, and remember Paul's statement in Romans 14:5 that the Sabbath, speaking in this context of the Sabbath, he says, let everyone be persuaded in his own mind. Now, isn't that just leaving it up for personal choice? What issue should we really make of this? Isn't it just a matter of how you feel about it or your personal opinion, as far as at least the Sabbath is concerned, the fourth commandment is concerned?
If we take it that way, that would suggest that when it comes to deciding which God you're going to follow, you're not free to make up your own mind or any of the others. It's only with respect to the Sabbath. It seems to me that if we have not made up our own minds freely about God, then our worship is worthless. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind is the way God approaches us on everything he asks us to do. It isn't just with respect to the Sabbath. So that doesn't suggest the Sabbath is less important because we're free to make up our own minds. It just says, with respect to love, trust, obedience, you name it, we're free to make up our own minds.
He isn't saying it doesn't matter what you think.
No.
He's saying you have freedom to choose.
And that's why he says, therefore don't go around condemning other people. God does not condemn them. Everyone is free to make up his own mind.
But he isn't saying all roads lead to the same place.
No, not at all.
That it doesn't matter what choice you make.
The choice is very important, but it still must be yours.
It's not forced upon.
Now, before that, he wouldn't say, one man esteems one day above another, another man esteems all days alike, let everyone be persuaded in his own mind. Before he knew God is gracious on the Damascus Road, he would say, I know some of you are wrong on this, and I'm on my way to put you into prison, and I'll have you stoned for doing it. Not anymore. Now he'd learned that we're not under law, we're under grace.
In your presentation this evening, it seems clear that you're convinced that we need to be attentive to all 10 of the commandments. But isn't a person, you've mentioned the word legalist here, mm-hmm. Isn't a person who is concerned about the law, who is even thinking about the 10 commandments, mm-hmm. Isn't such a person a legalist? Isn't that the meaning of legalism, a person who thinks about the law? Shouldn't we be thinking about Jesus rather than about the law?
Well, it's interesting when you think of the fact that to obey the law is to love. This suggests that the loving person is the legalist. And then it doesn't seem to make sense. But I think on a broader basis, one needs to consider the real meaning of legalism. Currently, my best understanding of the meaning of legalism is this. I believe that the essence of legalism is preoccupation with our legal standing with a legalistic God. And so many Christians are preoccupied with their legal standing because they don't really know God. They don't realize that he is a gracious God who is not preoccupied with our legal standing. But like the father of the prodigal son, he's very preoccupied with our welfare and whether or not we'll come home. That's what God is preoccupied with. So unfortunately, the word legalism is often misused. So, I repeat it, the essence of legalism is preoccupation with one's legal standing with God.
Well, now, Graham, then you're saying that a person might not be just concerned about the Ten Commandments. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Could a person believe and accept, for instance, Christ's sacrifice in his or her place in such a way, could he or she think about that in such a way that they would, in effect, be a legalist?
Yeah, this is something to say very carefully. But I really believe that's true. If you believe Jesus died primarily to adjust our legal standing with a God who's preoccupied with our legal standing, you are a legalist. And this means that you'd no longer take to God the blood of bulls and goats to adjust your legal standing. And I want to say this very reverently. We now take him, the blood of his son, and say, will this adjust my legal standing? He said, that's good. Now you've brought me the right blood. This is legalism.
So you're saying that the focus of our idea of salvation or our experience of salvation on some kind of meeting a legal requirement or satisfying some legal requirement becomes a matter of legalism.
Ah, that's the devil's sad perversion. He's actually taken the death of Christ, which is a monument to freedom, and suggests that God is not preoccupied with our legal standing. He's turned that into just another ceremony to adjust legal standing. In other words, those who misunderstood the ceremonies in Old Testament times, but then became Christians, applied the same misunderstanding to the cross and to the blood of Christ. It's just that now they had better blood, and more persuasiveness with the Father to adjust their legal standing. It sounds terrible to say that.
With that, it seems to me you've opened the idea of the meaning and the problem of legalism to a much broader perspective, a very important perspective. You've given us something to think about.
And it supports the devil's charge. You see that God is arbitrary, exacting, vengeful, unforgiving, and severe. See, all legalism is based on the conception that God has to execute those who disobey him. Therefore, forgiveness will take care of it. That's what produces legalism.
Well, now, I want to come back to a basic question that I've heard again and again, and I'm sure it will be in the minds of many of our hearers. How do you answer the question, then, must one obey God's law to be saved? You've said the law is not a threat to our freedom, but on the other hand, don't I have to obey it in order to be saved?
Well, maybe the safest way to approach that in a brief time is to consider the word obedience. The biblical word means to hearken, to listen. The Greek word is to listen humbly. As Micah said, all God asks of us is that we walk humbly before our God. The thief on the cross didn't have much time to live up to all the precepts of the many, many laws that have been used as God's emergency measures. But he certainly was humbly and gratefully and reverently willing to listen to the one in the middle. And he died willing to listen, sincerely, honestly willing to listen. He will arise in the same frame of mind. And he has much to learn, but he'll be a good pupil, a good disciple. Like last week in church, he'll be a good disciple. That means he's willing to listen, to accept instruction, to accept correction.
Would you feel better then, Graham, if I didn't say you have to obey God's law to be saved? You have to listen to be saved.
Well, to go beyond that even, to obey God's law is to be loving.
Well, do I have to be loving to be
saved? Well, Jesus said to Nicodemus, unless you be born of the Spirit, you'll not be saved. And the man who's born of the Spirit, whose fruit is love and truth, will now have truth in the inner man. He'll have a new heart and a right spirit. Yes, I would say unless one has the essence of the beginning of this experience of love and trustworthiness, he will not be saved. And that's 1 John. Hereby we know we've passed from death unto life because we love the brethren. I mean, unless we see the beginning of new regard for each other, we do not have the first symptom of salvation.
Are you saying, in effect, that there's something wrong with the way I'm trying to press this question on you? You know, do I have to do this? I'm trying to find out, is there something I have to do to be saved? Is that the way I am saved? Am I saved because I do such and such?
I'd love to jump to that. To one of our latest meetings is on the matter of perfection. Do I have to be perfect? I would say in all these things, these are not things God demands of us. He offers to us. He says, I offer you a new heart. I offer you a right spirit. I offer you healing. Do you want it? If I don't want it, I'm not savable. In fact, the word save means to heal. If I say I don't want to be healed, but to be healed is to have a loving heart and truth in the inner man. Yes.
But let me try it another way, though.
But to put the Ten Commandments on the wall, the way one might do in a mechanical sort of a way, is to miss the whole point anyway.
But our subject tonight has to do with a threat to our freedom.
That's right.
Now, out of what you've said, let me ask this, I trust, respectfully. Am I really free if I have to love and obey? Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes.
I need to listen and love and obey. Then am I really free? I've got to do this.
Well, let's put it this way. If we live in a society where we don't love each other and we can't be trusted, there'll be no freedom.
Ah, good point.
There can't be freedom without it. There can't be freedom in a disorderly, chaotic society. In a lawless place, there can't be. So these are interesting questions. You see, isn't it interesting how you can phrase it in just such a way that it sounds like a burden, sounds like a restriction on our freedom, and then you stop to think, what's he asking us to do anyway? Just to love each other, to be trustworthy, to be safe, to be free? Who'd want to turn that down? You say, do I have to be free? Do I have to be safe? Do I have to be healthy? Do I have to be well? He says, no. And I can't command
I'm free to choose.
But I offer it to you. And some of us say, I like that very much.
When Jesus says, and you had this text in our Bible reference sheet here, Matthew 11, come to me and all you who labor mm-hmm. and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. But when you talk about listening and obedience, he says, my yoke is easy. Is this really easy? Is it light?
And light. In comparison with the many, many rules and regulations they had, which made no sense, it was very light. And yet Jesus says that you have omitted the weightier matters in the law. So in a sense, it's heavy. What is love is weighty and heavy
more
in the sense of importance. It's very important. I think what makes God's commandments light is that they make such good sense, that they call for our intelligent obedience. And when I obey something intelligently, I want to do it. It makes sense. It's dumb not to. Then the burden is gone. I think it's in that sense because it actually calls for complete commitment, doesn't it?
And if we end up describing or trying to describe the kind of world that we'd like to live in where things would be wonderful and different from the kind of trauma we find in this world, we end up describing the world that God has invited us to live
exactly.
in. What is the truth? You concluded by talking about the truth that sets us free. Just remind us again. What is the truth?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the legal model, the truth is we've been forgiven and won't have to go to hell. I think the truth that sets us free is the truth about God, the kind of person that he is.
Does forgiving a person set that person free, just forgiving them?
Forgiveness doesn't change the heart necessarily. And remember last time I mentioned that heaven will not be peopled with forgiven crooks. I mean, if heaven
we're
is...
still crooks.
We're still crooks. Unless the heart is changed, there'll be no real freedom. Well, this brings up again the difference between the legal model and the real healing health trust model. And last time in the after service, I used a brief illustration that I found helpful.
Yes.
I mean, supposing you had to keep rat poison. We're having a lot of trouble with rats right now. Well, I've got some. Suppose you had to keep rat poison in your house and you have a young son. And if he touches it, eats it, he could be very sick, even die. So he says, son, don't touch that rat poison. I'm going to put it on the highest shelf behind a locked cupboard. A little later, you hear a crash in the garage. And you run out, and there's your son lying on the floor. He's taken the rat poison, and he's dying. Would it do any good to say, son, I forgive you, I forgive you? He'd just die forgiven, that's all. It wouldn't keep him from dying. Nor would it do any good to say, son, I don't want you to die, so let me drink the rat poison. Now you both die. The boy doesn't need forgiveness. He needs an antidote. Mm-hmm. He needs healing. But God didn't wait for that. God has said, you don't really take me seriously, do you, that sin is like a poison and will lead to your death. Let me take the poison. And Jesus died. And we, like the son, say, Dad, it's real, isn't it? I mean, nobody's killing you. Sin is really a poison, and you are dying. I will take you seriously from here on. The beauty is that God then was able to take his life back and go on living. I've made my point. There's no legal requirement in that. There's an awesome truth to be revealed. There's nothing arbitrary in this thing. God does not want us to poison ourselves. And forgiveness doesn't keep us from the results of being poisoned. We need healing. Better heed the warning. The results of sin is death, and don't do this thing. That's the other model. That's the healing model, not the legalistic model.
Now, we've tried to deal with some of the questions that have come up in a general way. I'd like to move to several specific questions that have come up from our congregation. Here's one. Growing up as an Adventist, I always thought the Sabbath would be one of the big issues at the end of time. Is the Sabbath something we should hold on to as a belief strong enough to die for, if it is a temporary emergency measure just for the present? That's a very good question.
That's a very good question. Certainly the great controversy is not over a day. It's over a commitment. It's over a great truth. And it's the meaning of the Sabbath that speaks to that truth that makes it an important issue. That those who meaningfully observe the Sabbath in the last days will be publicly declaring they worship Christ as their God, that the Father is just as gracious as the Son, and all the other things we talked about two times ago. Apart from the meaning of the Sabbath, then there's not a very good answer to that question. But in the light of its meaning, yes, indeed. The Sabbath could be a central issue of enormous consequence. And because of its meaning, it could be continued through eternity. Because think of all there'll be to remember in the hereafter. A monument to freedom.
We've had this kind of question come in many times, and I'd like to take this specific one as a sample of many who've asked this kind of question. If God's purpose is to restore to love relationship with his children, how could asking them to kill an animal, this has to do with the emergency measures that you spoke about in the Old Testament times, how could God asking them to kill an animal do this? In my opinion, this would only tend to make people cruel and harden their hearts rather than create a loving, sympathetic spirit. It would seem to me it would reflect the cruel spirit of Satan rather than the loving, gracious God. What about
unfortunately, it has had that effect because many people offered the sacrifice in hopes that God would love the smell and forgive them and bless them, and it became a rather satanic thing. God must have hated this emergency measure, and yet it had to be that dramatic. Well, as for Adam, for example, when he killed the first lamb to be convinced that sin is serious, it does lead to death. I wonder how hard he hit that lamb, and what did he hit it with? Not hard enough to kill it, just hurt it. And he hit it harder. Then blood appeared. He'd never seen that before. And Adam turns to God and says, God, I'm not sure I can go on with this. It's making me sick. And God says, may it always make you sick every time. But they became so accustomed to it, they could do it almost as a circus, Josephus says. Cutting the animals up and brandishing them as they placed them on the altar to be burned. They'd forgotten the meaning. That's the thing. So God chose something, like many of his emergency measures, rather awesome, sometimes rather horrible, in order to sufficiently impress his people.
I can hear our questioner saying, well, but with all of these risks, why would God go ahead recognizing that this could happen? Wasn't there a better way?
Like some people wish the whole Bible could have been written differently and made a little clearer. I would say the all-wise one used the very best way he knew how, and some have not misunderstood. Some have said, if you're the one who sees the little sparrow fall and you asked us to kill these animals, it must have been, in your wisdom, necessary to impress us sufficiently. And to have, of course, the particular meaning that an innocent one was going to come and die this death later on.
Related to last week and the emergency measures, a questioner writes, I was disappointed that you used Galatians 3:19, 24, and 25 as referring to the Ten Commandments, whereas Paul is concerned about the doctrine of circumcision, and the entire book was to endeavor to change their view of the ceremonial law, see Acts 15 and so on. Isn't it true that the sacrificial system is the added law? Doesn't Colossians 2:14-16 talk about a law that was to be blotted out?
One could readily come to that conclusion, but I think one would pay a price for taking that view and not including all law. What has happened is we think of a legalist as a person who still follows the ceremonial law, and we say there's no way you could be legalistic about the Ten Commandments. And yet the most damaging legalism has been with respect to the Ten, and maybe the most damaging has been with respect to the fourth of the Ten Commandments. So I believe Paul's point is about all law. All law was an emergency measure to bring us back to faith and a right relationship.
All right.
I think that's the point. And so if you leave out the Ten, you're suggesting there's no way you can be legalistic about the Ten.
Let's see if we can cover these two in these last 2 minutes here. If the universe was satisfied when Christ died, then why are we still here?
Oh, that's a great question. We have one coming up soon. What is God waiting for is something I think we ought to carry in mind right through our remaining conversations. What is he waiting for? Why did he wait so long to send his son? Why is he waiting so long to send him back the second time?
Here's an intriguing one. Would we lose our freedom if God always rewarded the righteous? If righteousness always pays off, why...
That might explain why he doesn't sometimes, as with Job in Scripture. It's true, if every time I did what was right, God would reward me. See what that would do in the way of motivation. Then I do what I do because God has told me to, and he has the power to reward and destroy. I think that would produce obedience number one. And so people like Job were not rewarded right away, and he loved God anyway. Though God slay me, yet will I trust him, that friend of God was able to say.
You made some mention here, and then number three about why we obey. He commands me to do something beyond my present understanding. Yes. My trust is such. And that may be true even when it appears that righteousness is not rewarded.
Right.
What is the difference between killing and murdering? Is it because the damage is yourself by just hating your brother? And another person says, I'm confused. Thou shalt not kill is a commandment, and yet God told his people to kill. Can you touch on that very quickly?
Yeah, the Hebrew and the Greek words both mean murder. Thou shalt not murder. Many modern versions so translate it. And what's so bad about murdering is, as was mentioned there, what happens inside. And Jesus said, he who hates his brother has done the damage. He is a murderer. And God has never said, go and murder people. Now, he did instruct them to go and kill in battle, but he didn't want them to. It's very clear. He said, let my angel do it. Let me put my children to sleep. He never wanted them to kill at all. That, too, was an emergency measure. But at the end of the millennium, God doesn't violate that law. Do you think he hates his children as they die? He doesn't even kill them. He watches them die and he cries. God has never violated his Ten Commandments. Never.
Let's take just a moment, Graham, to talk about next Friday evening's number 13 in
13.
Our series. How God treats his erring children.
Yeah.
What's
to me,
that's
the most convincing evidence that God is not arbitrary, exacting, vengeful, and severe. In demonstration, not in words.
Is this what happens when we sin and how God
treats us?
That'll be an important one.
Not that his kindness would make us careless about sinning. It makes you feel a much worse crook and much less grateful when you do sin.
Next Friday night.